This podcast is brought to you by Voice of Vets. Voice of Vets. Hear it. Feel it. Feel it. Feel it.
As we are getting into My Rights, 1040 is your time right here on VFM 88.1. Hashtag area code. We are getting into My Rights. And Kaylin Dednow graduated with an LLB from University of the Witwatersrand right here, VFM 88.1 in 2007. She completed 2 years of articles and admitted as an attorney at a notary public in 2010. In 2013, she was admitted as a conveyancer. Ooh, child. And she's been a director at Wirtz Incorporated since 2006. She practiced civil litigation, conveyancing, property and commercial law since 2008. Good morning, Kaylin.
Hi there, how are you?
We are all fantastic. We're just excited about this chat that we're having this morning. Property law. When looking for property, is it mandatory to get an estate agent?
So it's not mandatory. There's nothing that says that you have to. It is advisable to, though, because it comes with a measure of accountability. So estate agents are obliged to do some level of homework into the person that's selling the property before putting it on the market and before marketing it. So at least if you know, you know, when you buy the property through an estate agent, that there's some sort of due diligence that has gone into that person. It's not just a It's usually not a con artist or a scam or something like that, which is where the risk is when you try to do it privately. Unfortunately, it happens all too often where, you know, you meet someone and they tell you they own the property and then they actually don't and you end up paying the money. So to involve an estate agent just really assists both parties to ensure it minimizes that risk. It minimizes a lot of risk in that sense, because they will go out and they will fika the seller and they will ensure that they own the property, and they will also inspect the condition of the property and things like that, and they're held accountable through the estate agents board. So it just introduces the safeguards for both of the parties, which is why not mandatory but definitely recommended in that sense.
Now, Kaylin, you're just mentioning the importance of having an estate agent, and maybe let's look at some of the costs that one should be aware of other than the actual house price, because using an estate, you get charged for it. So what are some of the hidden costs, maybe if I may put it that way, in inverted commas, that are associated with purchasing a house outside of the actual house price?
Sure. Okay. So generally, it would be the seller that would appoint the estate agent to market their property. And so where that happens, the seller's a commission would then be for the account of the seller. So it would be deducted from the purchase price that the purchaser would pay. And that amount would then be paid to the agent effectively by the seller. So that wouldn't even necessarily be a cost for the purchaser's account, but it would afford them that protection. The costs that are for the purchaser's account would be the transfer duty that is payable to SARS. Any purchase price below 1 million rand would be exempt from transfer duty. So if you buy a property that's less than 1 million rand, you wouldn't be paying that transfer duty to SARS. For anything above 1 million rand, it works on a sliding scale according to the value of the property. So if the fair value of the property is more than 1 million rand, there's a sliding scale percentage that you would have to pay to SARS, and that is the calculation for that is accessible on their website. So that would be for the purchaser's account. The other costs for the purchasers would be the conveyancing account, the conveyancing costs that would be payable for the transferring attorney to actually attend to that transfer process. It's something that can only be done by a conveyancer. So for people that are making use of a private sale, who are not aware of that, that would be a red flag. So if you approach someone to buy their property and they say, you know, don't worry, just pay me the money and I'll sort it out, and you don't actually then go meet with an attorney, that should be a red flag, because a property transfer can only be done by a conveyancer, and a conveyancer has to be an admitted attorney. And because it is a process that is handled by a professional, there are obviously the costs that are involved, and that is generally for the purchaser's account as well. And there are sort of various other nominal admin fees and things that a purchaser may be liable, but those are the two big ones for the purchaser: the transfer duty to SARS and the conveyancing costs that are payable to the conveyancer.
Now, Caitlin, when one is negotiating a proper negotiating a deposit towards a house, does one offer a random number or is there a set percentage to it?
So there isn't a specific amount that that one is obliged to pay. I'll tell you the two reasons that people do usually agree on a deposit. The rule of thumb is 10%, but it's negotiable. And as I say, the two reasons that people usually ask for deposits are firstly, a show of good faith, sort of like put your money where your mouth is. Show me that you're not wasting my time and messing me around by actually putting up some sort of cash as a show. And then the second reason is affordability. It's not so easy to get 100% bond from the bank these days. And generally, the bank would insist that you put up some sort of cash deposit as well, just to assist you with the affordability for paying off the bond, if you are getting a bond. So those are generally the two reasons why people would insist on a deposit. Show me that you're serious, you're not wasting my time, you're not just taking a chance. So put that down as a show of good faith. And then, as I say, the banks usually insist as well. And no set amount, but generally about 10%.
10%. That sounds about good, hey? Yeah. Now, I don't know if you've been following the Blade River Walk story. It's something that's been happening when it's an estate, and this past weekend they required residents to pay an entrance fee of 250 rand each. Now, I'm guessing that maybe the reason behind this is because they also have a private beach inside, which is obviously made, but it is something worth going and having a look at, you know. Is there a clause that allows them to do so randomly? Because I remember while having this conversation, Zakes as well also said that when he had to sleep over at a friend's place, he had to pay 100 rand. What constitutes these rights behind the 250 and the 100 rand for the sleepover?
So obviously quite a contentious issue, and obviously hotly debated on both sides. You know, you can understand it, I suppose, from the property owner's point of view, in the sense that this is a massive investment for everybody. You need to ensure that the value in that investment is retained. You don't want people to be, you know, spending money on buying these units and the place is degraded or whatever the case may be. And maybe also to some extent for the maintenance of the facilities and things like that, maybe it's warranted. But by the other, you know, token, you can also understand the people that have now bought into this under certain terms and conditions and now suddenly find that that's, you know, changed. And to go from 100 to 250 is maybe quite onerous, I suppose. So both sides, you know, perhaps equal merit. But I think when faced with things like this, there's two things that are important. Obviously, firstly, you need to have substantive reasons for doing it. So there needs to be fair and reasonable and justifiable reasons for imposing a potentially onerous penalty on people or admin fee. And there also has to be proper procedure. So where there may be have good reasons for doing so, one has to look at whether they follow correct procedure or fair procedure in doing so, which obviously entails giving both opportunities the right to be heard, to let it be debated, to give proper notice of meetings where it's going to be discussed, to have a thorough debate about it beforehand, to consider alternative measures if possible. All these kinds of due processes, it's just important that it, you know, that be implemented before the decision is ultimately made. And so where you can tick both of those boxes and the outcome of due process and fair reason is it's a good idea, then, you know, I suppose there's always the courts are available to have that set aside, which I think is where they're trying to head to CSOS, which is the ombudsman, to see if it's sustainable.
10:49 is your time this morning, Joburg. You tune into Area Code and we're hanging out with Zakes Twala and Preeti Ngwenya, and we're in the middle of My Rights. We're chatting with Caitlin Dednar, who is a property lawyer, and she's explaining us everything we need to know about property. Now, Caitlin, when the president has signed into law the Property Practitioners Act, what exactly does that law entail, and do we know when that is said to come into effect?
As I understand, they're still working on the regulations. I don't think the entire thing is coming to effect yet. It goes back to what I was saying before about estate agents and anyone else who is defined as a property practitioner, so brokers and you know people on the finance side and things like that, just to provide a regulatory framework for people in that industry to ensure that there isn't any unscrupulous behaviors, to ensure that they are regulated and held accountable. Because in many instances they're receiving, in many cases, for example, a sale agreement will say that that deposit that we discussed must be paid to the estate agent into their trust account. So when you are receiving and handling other people's trust money, there needs to be accountability. And so there was only a small sector of that industry that was covered previously by legislation. And the intention of this act is to extend that to really sort of protect the consumer. So it's just a drive to ensure that the entire industry and anyone who falls within the definition of that industry is held accountable, that there are regulations and rules that they must be held to ensure that the consumer and the public is protected.
So just to wrap it up, and we're looking at the eviction letter, you know, there's a lot that is surrounding eviction letter. Sometimes you get kicked out immediately, and, you know, there's a lot of questions around it. Now, what warrants an eviction letter, and how many days does one actually have or is required to leave the premises?
So when it comes to leases, the first place to start is the agreement, is the lease agreement between the parties. That's always... you know, we start there, which is why it's so imperative to actually have a written lease agreement in place. It always feels unnecessary until it's necessary, unfortunately. And so most lease agreements will stipulate in there, if you fail to pay your rent, then you are in breach. You've broken your obligations in terms of the contract. And where that happens, generally, the landlord is then required to give you a letter or a notice to say, fix your breach. So you haven't paid and you are in breach of your obligations. I'm giving you 7 days, 10 days, 2 weeks. It depends on what's agreed. I suppose 1 to 2 weeks is generally considered fair to both sides. So, you know, fix that breach, pay what you owe. Otherwise, there will be consequences. So the tenant should be afforded that opportunity, firstly, to actually take steps to bring their obligations, to bring their payments up to date. If they fail then to make that payment within that week or 2 week period, then the landlord is entitled at that stage to cancel the lease. So let's say that, you know, that's what occurs. Now there is no lease, essentially, which means that the tenant has no legal right to remain in the property. The landlord is not allowed to take the law into his own hands in that event. He cannot, you know, change the locks, take the door off, send around some people with baseball bats or things like that. That is all unlawful. So what the landlord needs to do is then follow the court process in terms of the Prevention of Illegal Eviction Act and obtain a court order to have the tenant evicted. So in terms of that, the lease, yes, there is notice that's provided, and it depends what is stipulated in terms of that. But where the tenant still remains in the property and doesn't leave the property, even though the lease has been cancelled and the tenant is not entitled to remain in there, the landlord can only actually effect the eviction under the supervision of the court. And the court will set the time periods that the tenant must leave and will have consideration to all of the factors involved. Are there children? Are there elderly people, disabled people, etc.? And then make a determination as to when that, you know, under compelling circumstances, it's not a free-for-all situation either. And the tenant would be obliged to prove to the court why the indulgence should be granted. But if those circumstances exist and the tenant is able to show that they exist, then the court would, you know, provide some sort of indulgence, another month maybe, or whatever the case may be. So yes, I suppose the guiding principle here is reasonableness. You know, yes, it's difficult for the landlord where you have a situation with a tenant that's not paying, and the landlord obviously has his own obligations that he must meet as well. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, the tenant finds themselves in this position for a reason as well. And I suppose parties must be fair to each other.
Now, Kaylin, from top of your head, 5 things one needs to look out for when purchasing property.
Okay, so this is a very good question. And, you know, for me, For me, the message that I would like to send to people more than anything is, if you approach someone to purchase their property, do not pay them any money until you have at least asked an attorney just to check that that person is indeed the true and lawful owner of that property. Because unfortunately, this happens time and time again, where someone will pay money and it turns out that the person that they paid the money to is not even the owner of that property. So, you know, I understand it might be intimidating or whatever, or expensive, maybe expensive, maybe not expensive, I don't know. But for me, the most important thing is, do not pay anybody any money until there's been some sort of due diligence process. And, you know, anyone, any member of the public can walk into the deeds office and they will assist with a property search to confirm, you know, who the owner of that property is. So that for me is very important, is just make sure, just do a bit of homework, do a bit of due diligence, especially before paying any money. So that would be number one. Number two, obviously, is also the condition of the property. A seller is not entitled to conceal anything. So that would be obviously fraud. But there is then also the principle of footstool, which means you buy the property as is. So where the seller can prove, well, he didn't know, you know, then you can't necessarily always hold him accountable. So as a purchaser, it's important to take to do a thorough inspection of the property. Where possible, take someone who has some sort of knowledge on construction, or who has been a homeowner before and knows what to look out for, things like damp or, you know, broken this or broken that or whatever the case is. So as a purchaser, just to do some sort of due diligence regarding the condition of the property. And then I suppose just to have an understanding of the costs that are involved. As a purchaser, my apologies, one of the costs that I forgot, if you intend to get a bond from a bank, you would be responsible for the bond registration costs as well. So that's a separate, that's an entirely separate process that's handled by the bank and their attorneys. And the purchaser, if they are taking finance from the bank, would be liable for those bond registration costs as well. So there's another part of the due diligence and the homework that one should do before committing themselves to a purchase, because it is, you know, it's an expensive and a process and a commitment. So just to understand the costs that are involved. And then to have a look at things like homeowners association rules. You know, as you mentioned, that case in Pretoria, that's also part of the due diligence, part of the homework. If you're buying into a sectional title complex, ask to see the rules of the body corporate. Ask to see the latest audited financial statements of the body corporate, so you can ensure it's not bankrupt. So you can ensure the body corporate is not in debt, that it doesn't have, you know, 10 years worth of maintenance to be done, which you are going to have to finance the day after you move in. So just to do a thorough, ask the questions, whatever needs to be asked, do the homework, do the due diligence, because the consequences might not be pleasant if you don't.
Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's absolutely amazing to have you on the show, because you're explaining to us things that we need to know when it comes to property before we even fall prey into scams.
Yes. And you know, don't be shy either. Just pick up the phone, make contact with an attorney, and just, as I say, ask the questions, do the homework, protect yourself, because nobody else is unfortunately going to do it for you. And that's our purpose as well. You know, that's what we are here as attorneys, as conveyancers. That is what we do every day. So please get in touch, ask the questions, and let's just go into this with our eyes open.
Thank you very much, Caitlin, for joining us.
This podcast was brought to you by Voice of Vids. By Voice of Vids. To hear more of our shows, tune in to 88.1 or stream via www.vofm.co.za.